From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll find out why Milwaukee's changing economy has national resonance. Later, why starting a food truck was easier for Steve Perlstein than opening a restaurant.
You know, if we don't want to run the truck, we don't take it out of the garage and we don't open. You know, if a location isn't working, we start the engine and we drive away and find another one.
A program tries to help urban residents see the forests for the trees. And we'll talk with the host of NPR's Ask Me Another about her unique memoir.
I didn't really think I was that out of control or really picking anything that was that different. As it turns out, not everyone just opens any door that says do not enter.
Lake Effect is next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Glad you could tune in today. Perhaps no story has been reported on in Milwaukee over the past 20 years as much as the transformation of the local economy away from traditional manufacturing. It's had an impact on employment, but that transition is also felt in countless other arenas. But while it continues to be a huge local issue, it's a story of national significance as well. The changing face of Milwaukee is the subject of a week-long series of reports in the National Journal and The Atlantic. They're the work of reporter Sophie Quinton, who joins us from National Journal's newsroom in Washington. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here.
This series on Milwaukee is part of a bigger series called The Next Economy, if I'm not mistaken. Why was it important to include Milwaukee as part of this series?
Well, the goal with our series is to profile folks on the ground, people, places, and organizations that are addressing with certain economic problems, either old problems or new problems as the country comes out of the recession. So in that work, we're going to a number of cities around the country, and we really wanted to include cities that are dealing with things like the decline in manufacturing jobs, places in different regions around the country. So the Great Lakes is one of the regions we were interested in. And we're also interested in mid-sized cities that don't get a lot of national attention, but where there are people doing interesting things. So Milwaukee fit a lot of the things that we were looking for.
The first installment, you referenced the idea that Milwaukee, or at least Mayor Tom Barrett, is seeking to help the city shed its Rust Belt image. That image, would you say, is very much a part of the way the rest of the country still sees Milwaukee?
I think that's pretty accurate. I mean, I think when I told people I was heading to Milwaukee, a lot of them said, well, what's going on there? A lot of people don't really know much about the city other than the fact that it used to be a big manufacturing hub and kind of hasn't been able to achieve the strength that it had in that sector back in the 70s.
Well, why do you think it's important that the rest of the country understand how the new economic realities are shaping a place like Milwaukee?
I think looking at these case studies on the ground really helps people think through the different challenges that people face, both specific to certain regions and also challenges that occur in places across the country. For example, in my series on Milwaukee, I write about a nonprofit in the inner city that's trying to grow a community there that's fallen on hard times, and that's something that any city in the country would love to learn more about because that's something that so many places struggle with.
How did you approach your assignment here? Even with five stories at your disposal, putting Milwaukee in context seems like a tall order.
Yeah, it takes a little bit of time. I had to make some phone calls. My general approach with these city trips is to start out by calling some of the big institutions in town. So the mayor's office, the Chamber of Commerce, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, some of the big guys, and asking a lot of people on the ground what is interesting about the town, what the major sectors are in the economy, and if there are any organizations that have come across their path that are sort of doing something that's new. So I start out by making a lot of calls. What I try to do with these week-long series is highlight three different sectors of the economy. So for Milwaukee, I wanted to write a piece about the manufacturing sector and the state that it's in today. I wanted to write a piece about the sort of challenges of addressing poverty in the inner city, because that's something that came up a lot when I was making my initial calls. And I also wanted to write a piece about the Water Council and the city's attempts to grow something new in the water technology area, because that's something forward-looking that's trying to gain some momentum.
Did you find it difficult to get past the PR aspect, if you will. I would imagine when you approach it from the outside, there are probably a lot of people that want to talk about how well things are going and what a bright future all the various sectors have.
Yeah, that's very true. But you sort of know when you make the call whether you're calling a place that's going to give you a bit of a PR spin. I find that oftentimes there are a lot of people in academia that might be able to talk straight with you. And also when you're on the ground and people meet you and are comfortable with talking to you, they'll start to open up about what's really going on.
I'm curious about the poverty angle. We've obviously done a lot of reporting on it from the inside. But as you explored the issue of inner city poverty in Milwaukee, how did you see it comparing to what other cities are struggling with?
Well, that's an interesting question because I thought about the similarities more than I thought about the differences. I think one of the things that Milwaukee struggles with is a lack of resources in the city as a whole. I mean, a city like Chicago is a place that has a lot of money and a lot of philanthropic dollars to throw around. Milwaukee has some of that, but they don't have as much of that going on locally. So that was one difference. I think another difference is that there's a Democratic administration in City Hall, and then there's a Republican administration in the state government. And I think when those two parties are aligned rather than divided, it can be easier to get policies in place that might be helpful or that folks on the ground think might be helpful.
Did you also see, was there evidence as you looked at it that segregation is making a significant difference in how the city approaches things?
I'm not sure if it makes a significant difference. That's definitely something that is particularly strong in Milwaukee, but it's present in other cities as well. It's sort of hard to get past because you're talking about racial segregation and economic segregation. And when people say segregation, sometimes they mean one thing and sometimes they mean the other. So I'm not sure whether the racial segregation part has made things significantly different in Milwaukee as opposed to other places.
You write about the decline of manufacturing and the emergence of industry, of new industries, but ones that don't necessarily bring a lot of jobs with them. Is that reflective of a larger national trend, do you see?
Yeah, I think it's definitely reflective of a larger trend. I think what we see across the country is that a lot of manufacturing companies that are doing really well are big global companies that are trying to keep people in the United States who have maybe a higher skill level than they might have overseas. And we're also seeing manufacturers across the world automate processes that used to require a lot of labor and used to keep a lot of people employed. So as I write in my piece, I think that companies that are on the cutting edge of manufacturing are big economic drivers, but they also don't employ as many people as they used to. And that's a problem in places like Milwaukee, where there are a lot of people who are out of work.
How well did you know Milwaukee before you came here?
I did not know it at all. I have one friend from college who lives in Milwaukee, and that is about it.
Well, and so I'm curious how the city met your expectations, even as you did your legwork before you came here.
I didn't really have very set expectations going in. The only place I've ever been in the Midwest is Chicago, and I didn't really have any other cities, either with a similar economic mix or a similar geographic location to compare it to. So, I mean, one thing that was unexpected that I didn't really realize before I got there is how many old 19th century and early 20th century buildings there are in the urban core downtown. I mean, that sense of history was something that I didn't think I would see.
How long did you spend here?
I was in Milwaukee for about a week, about 5 days.
Were there other aspects to the Milwaukee experience that jumped out at you in comparison to the other kinds of cities that you've reported on for this series?
Well, the only other city trip I've done so far that's been on the ground has been San Antonio, Texas, even though I've done a lot of reporting where I'm calling people who are on the ground across the country. I think that Milwaukee is similar to a lot of cities of the same size that sort of get away from the big cities on the two coasts, in that people are really friendly on the ground. I mean, you get a sense of that anywhere in the Midwest, but also anywhere really outside New York City. So there's that. And I think there's a sense, most of the people that I talked to liked living in Milwaukee and had a good feeling about its direction. And that was a nice thing to hear.
Well, Wisconsin's kind of been under a political microscope for the past few years. And I wonder, as a reporter from outside, whether that puts Wisconsin as a place to watch, either politically or economically.
Oh, I think it definitely does. I mean, that was something that interested me about Milwaukee as well, to be honest. I think that cities that have an interesting political mix tend to both be dealing with their own unique challenges, but there are sort of stories to tell there that you can't find in places where there isn't that conflict.
Any lingering impressions of Milwaukee that will stick with you long after this reporting is done?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough question. You're on the shore of a beautiful lake.
Well, Sophie Quinton, thank you so much for spending some time
with us.
Thank you. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask what the next city that's going to be part of this series will be.
You know, it's still under discussion. We're thinking maybe a city in the Rocky Mountains or maybe a city deeper into the Corn Belt.
Well, very good. We will be watching.
Okay, thanks so much.
Sophie Quinton joined us from Washington. She's a staff reporter for National Journal. Her series on Milwaukee's transformation is part of a broader series in National Journal and The Atlantic called The Next Economy. There's a link to it from wuwm.com/lake effect. 2013 brings a significant transformation to Steve Perlstein, who strikes out on his own as a food truck proprietor. We'll meet him when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. The food truck phenomenon was a bit late in arriving in Milwaukee compared to some cities, but there is an apparent renaissance underway. Buying food from a vendor on the street here is about more than lukewarm hot dogs. It's gourmet cuisine, ranging from Asian to pizza to West African to now soup. Steve Perlstein is optimistic that Milwaukeeans will enthusiastically slurp his tantalizingly sumptuous savory liquid concoctions. His enterprise, the Simmer Truck, officially comes off the back burner and to a full boil this weekend. Perlstein brought along some tomato basil soup to the Lake Effect studio recently and gave us what he hopes is his recipe for mobile restaurant success. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mitch. Great to be here.
It's great to have you here and great to have you bring some soup by the studio. Let me start you with this question. Why does Milwaukee need a soup truck?
Well, who doesn't like soup? And there's a few good soup restaurants in town, but you can't start those up and drive them around. And so
Let's talk about that point for starters, because you could be starting a soup restaurant like the other handful of soup restaurants that are out there. What is it about the truck part of the equation that's appealing to you?
Well, the original plan was to open up a brick and mortar soup restaurant right near here in downtown. But as we got into it, as we tried to find investors, as we tried to work out the logistics of all that, the truck just started making more and more sense. It costs about a fifth as much. It's cooler. It's mobile. There's a lot more flexibility. You know, my wife and I are doing this together, and it offers a lot more freedom for us. It's a lot more fun. So why not?
Well, and talk about your own soup cred, if you will.
I became a chef about 12 years ago after being a reporter for a lot of years and in publishing for a lot of years. And as I got more into cooking, as I did it more and more, longer and longer professionally, the part that really got me excited was soups and sauces, stocks. It's a fun process for me, building those layers of flavor. It's incredibly satisfying. I love eating soup, so I love making soup. And so I've just been playing with it and developing my own style of soup ever since.
You have been a professional chef in your career leading up to this. Talk about style. How would you describe your style of soup?
I'm a huge fan of technique. I don't try to limit myself to a certain kind of cuisine. I really focus on technique. And when I make soup, I focus on building layers of flavor. You know, people who make soup by throwing some vegetables in a pot and throwing some water and throwing some spices in, that's not me. You know, I'm sautéing the vegetables and sweating them, and I'm deglazing with wine, and I'm adding different layers, and at the end, I think it comes. You come out with something that's a richer, better flavor, deeper flavor.
You brought in a supply, if you will, a large thermos of
I didn't want anyone going hungry
of tomato basil soup. How would you put that the soup you brought into the Lake Effect bungalow in the context of that style you just described? Talk about the layers that come through in something that seems like a deceptively simple soup.
Yeah, that's a great example of it. So I start with onions and I'm sweating those onions.
Sweating. Talk about what does sweating onions mean?
That's a low temperature saute, so that you don't add any color. I'm just cooking them until they're essentially clear, and then I'm putting a pretty good amount of white wine in and deglazing it with the white wine, reducing that wine down so that the alcohol is not a factor, it's not a prevalent flavor, but the white wine flavor is. Then I'm adding ground tomatoes, and I'm adding vegetable stock. So that's those are other flavors. I do something a little unique with my tomato soup, and when I make marinara sauce, anything with tomatoes, especially canned tomatoes, I add raw peeled potatoes when I simmer it, because that takes out the acid without having to add sugar and making it sweet. And I take those out before I puree the soup. And then when I puree the soup, I also add basil, and I'm adding cream, so that's a whole other layer. So it's a little bit more elaborate than making a can of Campbell's.
A little bit. So as you said, you were planning on opening a bricks and mortar restaurant before the simmer truck idea came to you. What were the practical implications for deciding to open a food truck versus a restaurant, aside from, you know, things like where am I going to put gas into this thing?
Well, it was $40,000 versus $250,000 to start with. That's a pretty practical implication. And as my wife Jennifer and I started hashing this out, it just kept making more and more sense. So, okay, if we have a brick and mortar restaurant, it's open every day. Are we going to get to take a vacation? Are we going to get to take a day off? You know, if we don't want to run the truck, we don't take it out of the garage and we don't open. You know, if a location isn't working, we start the engine and we drive away and find another one. You know, and just as a you know, I'm kind of a romantic kind of adventurous kind of guy, and I like doing things that I think are cool. And it's way cooler to have a truck than it is to have a restaurant. And you know, we have friends in Portland where the food truck culture is huge, and you know, you look at places like Austin and Los Angeles where there's food trucks everywhere you look. That's starting in Milwaukee, but it hasn't quite gotten there, and I really would like to be a part of making that a huge part of the dining scene in the city, because people always, you know, you have the roach coach stereotype. People need to see that really great food can come off a truck, and it can.
The roach coach stereotype, this is the idea that, you know, somebody who has this battered old, you know, former ice cream truck with some anemic looking hot dogs going in a big vat.
Right. Or the you know, there's a lot of really, really good but really kind of basic like taco trucks on the South Side. Those are terrific. I love eating at those places. But, you know, when you start going to other cities and seeing the amazing things people are doing with food trucks, and you're seeing food that's more creative coming off of trucks than you are coming out of a lot of restaurants.
Is that because can you adjust the menu more frequently when you're running a truck? I mean, I'm curious about the creative angle, because you have a bricks and mortar restaurant, you can have a very large menu, whereas I would imagine with a truck you're limited in what you can have on the truck on any given day.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's very limiting in terms of space and in terms of, you know, you have to be very careful about what equipment you put in the truck. It's 10 feet long in the cooking area. You can't put a whole lot of stuff there. You know, you have to decide what equipment you have. You have very limited storage space. So I think that – so the answer to your question is kind of goes both ways. Yeah, you have to be creative in that way. But also, I mean, you could also just be very basic. I think that people are finding food trucks to be very sort of very freeing, you know. I mean, restaurants are more traditional. A food truck, there's really no rules. You do whatever you want.
I imagine people are curious. I mean, you know, there's not a food truck dealer on the west side of Milwaukee. You don't walk in and pick out a food truck and take it off the showroom floor. How do you get a food truck?
There are dealers in like there's a couple in California, and you can do that if you want to really pay through the nose. But you're right. It's a challenge. You know, there's a lot of used food trucks for sale, and we started looking in that direction, and we stopped looking in that direction when we saw the condition some of these things were in and what people were trying to sell, and it was a little scary, to be honest with you. We were looking at trucks that I didn't think would make it home.
There's probably not a big section in Kelly Blue Book for used food trucks either.
No, it's an evolving market. We'll say that. So I found a place in Ohio that customizes trucks, and he found us an actual bus.
You talked about the cooking area, but you're not going to be creating these soups on the truck, correct?
Correct. We are renting a kitchen that's owned by another food truck, the Gouda Girls, and we're renting that kitchen over in Bayview. And there's a few other food trucks that are working out of that space as well. So we're going to be making the soup there. We're going to be sealing it in 4 mil thick boil-in bags, specific food service grade bags, cooling those down in a nice bath. And then when we're on the truck, we have a fryer on the truck. We're going to fill that with water instead of with oil. And we're going to boil the soup to reheat it, and then we're going to hold it in the steam table and serve it to people there. We're also going to have salads with dressings, all the dressings we're going to make ourselves, and we're going to have paninis as well.
And in the time between now and when the food truck hits the road, you're testing recipes and perfecting things?
Testing recipes, going through the long permitting processes. I'm working on making sure everything is ready so that as soon as we have the truck, we can hit the streets right away. We just approve of the actual design of the truck, the decals and things like that. I'm doing a lot of work on social media right now. We're just finishing up a Kickstarter to get us our last little bit of funding. You know, I'm learning the wonders of Twitter and Facebook. So, you know, it's been an education, and it's been actually kind of cool. We're getting a lot of people following us on Twitter and liking us on Facebook without having a product, and it's been pretty gratifying to see how excited people are about what we're doing.
This is, if everything goes as currently planned, hitting the road in May. Are you at all concerned about the image of soup as a cold weather food?
No. You know, I was thinking about that. My wife and I went on vacation last November to the Bahamas, and every place you go has conch chowder, which I'm going to make because it was awesome. But, you know, I mean, you're on a tropical island. It's 80 degrees and sunny, and everyone's eating soup. You know, and when we're at the courthouse on Thursdays or at Schlitz Park on Tuesdays or Red Arrow Park on Fridays, we're going to be sandwiched in between, you know, a truck serving hot barbecue and a truck serving burgers and fries. And you know, there's going to be plenty of other food that's just as hot as ours and, frankly, is a lot heavier. So I'm not too worried about it.
You talked about these other food trucks out there. Obviously, you had to kind of survey the market to figure out what's out there. Are you fans of other food trucks in town?
Yeah. Every chance I get, I go to the Gouda Girls truck and grab one of their cheesesteaks because it's really good. I love American Euros, which is a cart. They just opened actually a brick and mortar restaurant half a block from my house. And I love their Euros. So yeah, there's some good food, and one of the nice things about food trucks is it's a community, and food trucks stick together. And we've had a lot of really nice conversations, and gotten a lot of great support from the other food trucks that we've talked to. And you know, more food trucks is better for everybody, and everybody realizes that, and it's pretty cool.
Well, Steve Perlstein, thanks so much. Best of luck to you.
Thanks, Mitch.
Steve Perlstein is a former journalist and the current proprietor of The Simmer Truck, a food truck specializing in soup, which hits the road this weekend. You can learn much more about The Simmer Truck from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Why Our Nation's Forests Should Matter to People in the City, a program connects urban dwellers with the woods, and we'll learn about it when we return on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Most of the largest cities in this country are far removed from the wilderness, but that does not mean that places like national forests are not relevant to urban residents. A U.S. Forest Service program is working to strengthen the bonds of city dwellers with the woods. The Forest Service's Region 9, based here in Milwaukee, operates the Urban Connections Program in six cities. The program's managers were in Wisconsin recently, and four of them joined us in the studio. Terry Heyer from the Twin Cities, Jesse Scott from Boston, Lisa Perez from Detroit, and Gene Claussen of Milwaukee. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You obviously can't take millions of trees and drop them into the middle of a city or a classroom. What are the connections that you work to create?
The Forest Service, we manage the national forest, but we also manage, we just say the nation's forest because they're urban forests as well. So that's kind of the areas we're working in is the urban forest, which is basically the tree canopy in the urban areas. And so by connecting urban residents to their local green spaces in their own backyard, and then kind of we operate with kind of a graduated experience, then they're more comfortable with being outdoors and enjoying it. And then, you know, then maybe going to a park or a forest an hour away and then taking them up, a group up maybe to a national forest, which may be 3 to 5 hours away in some of our cities.
Well, I was going to ask that. Is there any substitute for actually spending time in a forest? Is part of telling this story the physical getting people into a wooded environment?
Yes. Well, we work primarily with our partners to do just that. Yep. For example, in the Detroit area, we work with the Henry Ford, which manages Greenfield Village that has a wonderful natural area. And working through them, we're able to have urban folks take tours of this natural area, go on hikes. And another area, Belle Isle, which is a park right in the middle of the Detroit River, we working with school teachers, we bring their students on field trips in the forest of Belle Isle.
Same here in Milwaukee. It's all through partners that we are able to connect our the urban residents. They've got those relationships here in Milwaukee. We're working with Keep Greater Milwaukee Beautiful, Neighborhood House, who does a great job of connecting all the youth that go there to nature. We have an urban treehouse site that's right near Neighborhood House, and they bring school kids there. And we also work with the Urban Ecology Center. They're creating that new arboretum here in Milwaukee, and the Forest Service's part is some funding that was provided to create a children's forest.
What are the specific kind of programs that you're doing in Boston and in the Twin Cities?
So one example of a program that we're doing in Boston involves the Boston Children's Museum. The Forest Service, along with the Wyland Foundation out of California, has a program called FOCUS, that is Forests, Oceans, Climate, and Us. And in July, we're going to do a program at the museum where kids will have an opportunity to get out, learn about water conservation, and then do that creative part where they paint the sidewalks and paint murals to help spread the word of water conservation.
And in the Twin Cities?
In the Twin Cities, one of our main partners is Wilderness Inquiry, and they work in a pyramid model where they get about 10,000 kids from the Minneapolis and St. Paul summer school programs out on the Mississippi River in terrific canoes that fit 10 to 12 people. They're very stable. And then they work, as Gene said, in these graduated experiences where they go camping nearby, and then eventually we're getting some of those kids up on their national forests in Minnesota, the Chippewa and the Superior, and there they might do a service project. They'll do some additional recreational experiences, and they'll also might visit a college while they're there so they can think about what a natural resources career would be, which is important because if you asked every one of us that work in the field, our enthusiasm for this type of work started somehow in the outdoors.
Well, and actually, I was going to ask that question. What is it that gets you excited not just about working and doing Forest Service work, but this specific area of forest work? What is it about the nexus of the Forest Service and the urban environment that gets you so fired up?
I think something unique that Urban Connections can bring to the Forest Service also is us learning about the communities that we work with and bringing that back to Forest Service leadership. An example of that is in Minnesota and Wisconsin. You both have large Hmong community population. So we developed an educational CD where we focused on things like public recreation, regulations, camping safely. But we did it in a storytelling theme that used more of their animalistic nature themes for religion. And for instance, after a forest fire, a squirrel came back and asked them, why did my forest go away? And they talked about camping safely. So we adapted this message to a way that was more meaningful to that community.
I was going to ask, is there something about delivering this message in a demographically sensitive way, if that makes sense? I mean, you're speaking about the Hmong community, but there are any number of diverse communities that are involved in living in an urban environment, and I would imagine that some of them would get different messages out of what you're doing than others.
Yeah, that's true. Another example, Terry talked about the Hmong population. That might be some information that we're learning in the cities about the different populations we're working with that we can relate to the forests that help in their forest planning. One example would be like the Hispanic population. Studies have shown tend to want to recreate with their whole family, large extended families. And so maybe that's something the forest can take into consideration and help with planning picnic grounds and campgrounds and things like that.
Well, and let me get back to that earlier question about what gets you excited about this particular aspect of your work. What is it about the three of you that you not only want to work in this field but in this part of this field?
Well, I'll just share from me and my experiences in Detroit, it's really being able to see the interactions between folks that really haven't had a chance to explore the outdoors and see them move from kind of a fear. And initially as they hike down their trail, they're thinking about snakes and spiders and all the scary things that might be associated. But then towards the end, they're busily exploring a decaying log and all the critters that they might find on that, and just seeing that change in their perception has just been fabulous.
And I would actually echo that in a large way. It's being able to share that interest that we have. You know, we're all interested in the environment. We have a connection, and we want to share that connection. We want to give people that opportunity to learn about what's in their backyard, and especially when working with the younger groups. You know, just their enthusiasm and excitement to learn, especially when they learn something for the first time and you see that aha moment. And, you know, having those opportunities both throughout the school year, but especially in the summer when, you know, you can continue that learning. And, you know, and studies have shown that during the summer, young kids really kind of fall behind because they, you know, are distracted by other things, their TV, what have you, and they just stop learning. And so they actually fall behind when it's time to go back to school.
What fires you up about this?
I just love seeing a lot of the youth we work with getting excited about nature and just having fun outside and becoming more comfortable with it. We have a site called the Urban Treehouse site, which is managed by Keep Greater Milwaukee Beautiful. And the goal of that site is to just get the neighborhood youth and the folks in that community to get outside and enjoy it. And we do seeing them do service projects where they're actually taking part in something in their community. I remember one young boy, we were planting trees, I believe, on that site. It's a 3-acre site in the heart of Milwaukee. And he always says, he got interviewed for something, and he's like, well, I always hang out here with my friends or ride my bike down that hill, but I'm not going to I don't want anybody riding down there anymore messing up all the hard work I did, because he had a stake in it when he got involved in the planting. So, and I also remember taking some with our conservation education intern team. We have 4 college kids that go out to sites throughout Milwaukee teaching about nature and the environment. And they took a group of teenagers from Neighborhood House up to the Shawamigan Nicolet. And just
oh, seeing their excitement when they had a campfire and got to go swimming and fishing, and it just, yeah, I think like Jesse said, just sharing that, our love of nature with them and seeing the joy in their faces when they experience it.
This seems like it would be a hard program to attach a lot of quantitative data to. How do you measure whether this has worked? I mean, you get a kid excited about it, and they're excited about it certainly in the moment, but how will you know that this has been a success 5 years from now or 10 years from now?
Well, one of the programs we're working with in Minneapolis-St. Paul is trying to encourage, as we said before, kids to choose this as a career path. So we're about 3 years into this initiative, and we're starting to see if any of these kids are going to, one, we say graduate from high school. Two, think about a college experience, whether that's a community college and you can take on more of a technician position, or it could be a four-year college. So are they finishing high school? Are they going on to college? Are they choosing a natural resource career? And we've seen this with some of the interns that we've hired. In fact, one of them now is working as an arborist for the city of Milwaukee. So when you're there for multiple years, you can start to track over time the impact.
And I would echo that with one of the programs, Urban Forest Stewards, that we're doing in the Detroit area. We did a pre and post fill a survey of the students. And the one of the questions is, what kind of career would you think about doing in the future? And most of the students were saying things like doctor, lawyer, actor, you know, all the kind of typical urban careers you'd think about. And when the same thing was applied after the experience they had throughout the year, at least 20%, if not between 20 and 25% of the students put things like forest ranger, firefighter, careers that they really hadn't even contemplated existing before.
Well, it's exciting stuff. Thank you to all four of you, and best of luck this summer.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Gene Clausen manages the U.S. Forest Service's Urban Connections program in Milwaukee. Jesse Scott manages it in Boston, Lisa Perez in Detroit, and Terry Heyer in the Twin Cities. There is a link to more information about Urban Connections at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then Ophira Eisenberg, the host of NPR's newest quiz show, chats about her memoir of her, shall we say, philandering ways. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. The NPR quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, made its name through its irreverent take on the week's news. NPR's latest quiz show, Ask Me Another, is perhaps a few degrees less reverent. It features puzzles, guests, the music of Jonathan Colton, and the wit of host Ophira Eisenberg. Eisenberg is a stand-up comedian, native of Calgary, Alberta, and as her memoir describes in great detail, formerly a devoted practitioner of promiscuity. It is probably not necessary to point out that her memoir, called Screw Everyone, Sleeping My Way to Monogamy, is for a somewhat mature audience, though it might not get an NC-17 rating. Ophira Eisenberg joins us from NPR in New York. Great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Mitch.
So when, or maybe the better question is, why did you decide your romantic history was a book?
As they say, sometimes the project comes to you. I'm going to say that. I was actually performing a lot of these stories on stage as part of The Moth, which is a storytelling organization where people tell true stories from their life on stage. And I would tell, you know, 5-minute versions or whatever. And I also do stand-up. Sometimes I would tell some of these stories within my stand-up if it fit. And I got a really good reaction from people. And sometimes I got surprising reaction from men that they were like, oh, I've never really heard this kind of perspective, because I guess in my stories I'm self-deprecating, but I'm also not powerless or crying or wondering, like, why don't these guys like me? And I've met an agent, actually, through doing some of these shows who helped me figure out that it was worth putting out there and putting together a proposal. But I didn't even realize till I published it that it was a brave thing to do. Someone was like, wow, that's pretty wild you put that stuff out there. I was like, really? Oh, no.
Well, right. I mean,
I thought of that.
Well, and I wonder if it strikes you as odd that the people who read this book and speak with you about it, i.e. a radio interviewer,
yes,
have this uncommon insight into your sex life, whereas you have no insight into most of theirs.
Well, I can gather a lot just from talking to you, Mitch. No, that is true. I realize there's a lot of people floating around that know way more about me than is even some of my best friends, unless they read the book. But I don't know. I feel like everything that is in there, I don't mind people knowing. I'm not I don't feel bad about it. I think it's kind of great if they relate to it, or at least they get a laugh. I feel like as long as they're entertained, my job is done.
Well, you write this less like a person in recovery. I mean, obviously the subtitle is Sleeping My Way to Monogamy. So there's obviously a change that happens. But you don't write this like a person in recovery. You write it like a chronicler.
Yes. Yes. And, I mean, that was the advantage of writing it from where I am now is that I had perspective on the stories that were when I was sort of dating and bumbling around and trying to figure myself out. And the fact that now I am actually happily married, and I have to say actually because it always blows people's minds, that I had enough perspective to look at these stories from a different lens. I think when I was going through them or even when I was a little closer to them, I just thought of them a little differently. So I was able to be able to have a voice of a more chronicler just vis-a-vis the perspective I have now.
Was there anything in the process of doing this that was like reconciling that period of your life to yourself?
Oh, my goodness, yes. You sit there and start – there were portions of writing these stories where I would cringe just remembering. All of a sudden you'd go, okay, let's write out this story. And you remember like being in some bar at someone's house or waiting near the phone. And I was embarrassed by what I would remember myself thinking or how desperate I was. Some of it was really very hard to write. And others, a lot of the other stuff I thought, wow, you know, I didn't understand the process at the time. But it was nice even for me to go, oh, wow, I actually learned from that experience because that next time when it came up, I did not repeat the same mistake. Some of it felt like therapy at the time, and then I had to sort of take a step back because I wasn't going to write anything that sounded like therapy. I wanted to be sure that it was funny, entertaining, and fit for, you know, someone to read rather than something that was just like, wow, this girl seems a little unhinged.
Well, and really, when was the next time you were going to go home with a fellow comedian and find his bedroom stocked with Garfields?
Right. How many times can that happen? You know what? I have to be careful about saying things like that, because usually when you go, what are the odds of that? You find out the odds are one in one. So, yeah, but that was a particularly interesting. And, you know, I set up that story, too, where it's something much more dangerous could have been the payoff. But if the payoff is that you know, you're going to a stranger's house and strange things could happen and they put you in a scenario where what is behind that door and then you find out it's 300 Garfield, still chilling, but in the realm of the world, adorable.
And it really was maybe the best invocation of the word Odie in print, I think, in history.
Thank you.
Well, so obviously you have to have some belief that this is a life slightly out of the ordinary or it wouldn't make a memoir. But does the putting it down on paper, do you reflect on how different it was from place to place? I mean, this is it seems like way out of line for Calgary, but somewhat less out of line for New York.
The experiences? Yeah. I think when I was writing and when I even conceived it, I always came from that perspective that I thought I was doing the same thing as everybody else. I really thought that. Like even in Calgary, I knew I wanted to do things that were different than everybody. I always was that girl that I was like, okay, everyone's wearing pink sweaters. I'm going to wear a green sweater. Like that was definitely my mentality. But in terms of my actions, I didn't really think I was that out of control or really picking anything that was that different. As it turns out, not everyone just opens any door that says, do not enter. I thought everyone kind of did that. I'm like, but aren't you curious what's on the other side? And I find a lot of people are like, no, I just follow the sign. I was like, oh, it's an interesting way to approach life. But New York, so Calgary is much more heterogeneous than maybe I wrote about it, because I wrote it from my perspective. But New York, of course, is incredibly diverse in every sense of the word, and it's pretty hard to stick out here.
Do you feel like are you a different person than as a married monogamous writer than you were as a non-married, non-monogamous, non-writer?
To a certain point, yes. And I always say, if you know, you would be a fool to not let life change you. So if I ended up being the same person I am now, that would be a real problem. That would be zero. I don't believe in social evolution so much, but I certainly believe in life being a little bit of a project where things get better as you go on, and you should grow and be affected by your experiences. And I would never want to go back to those days. I kind of see it like high school, or just being a young adult, or just being in an education process where, you know, I graduated and people are like, don't you miss going around and having experiences, adventures, dating? And there are some thrills I miss, but there's so many other things about it that I'm so happy I never, hopefully, have to go through again.
The tassel has been moved to the other side of the mortarboard.
Exactly.
Which I'd never thought of as a euphemism.
That's brilliant. That is brilliant.
So this is obviously not a mystery book, so I'm not going to say spoiler alert, even though I just did.
That's right. But the title spoils it.
Right. There's a point late in this book in which you come across your then-boyfriend's list of all the women he slept with, and it really disturbed you on a couple of levels. What was it that bugged you so much about that?
Okay, so there was a couple things. The list I thought was all the people he slept with, but it was actually all the people he had been with. Now, I didn't know that at the time. I thought it was who he slept with. So there was a couple things. Now, who, you know, this is the pot calling the kettle black, of course. But what the seeing a list at all, that idea of someone chronicling it and making it somewhat clinical, I think the sort of absence of any emotion about it, just this list, and my name was at the end of it, like, thank God, the end, but still felt very, made me feel very generic and not special. He had little words besides some of them that were descriptive words on maybe what kind of kissers they were, or different things about their body type, or different, you know, descriptions of their skill level. But right beside my name, it had the most insulting thing of all time, because it just read comedienne, the feminized, made-up version of comic for women that I think is one of the most sexist terms out there on the planet, and I was enraged. It's so funny. He had said, you know, with perspective, a lot of worse things about a lot of other girls on that list. But I was like, how dare you? How dare? And all of a sudden, all the number of people didn't matter to me. The other girls didn't matter so much. But the fact that I was a comedian, I was like, this guy will never, ever, ever touch me again. Of course, I learned later that, you know, he didn't know.
He meant no harm.
He was like, really? That's a bad word? I had no idea. I was like, yes, that is an outdated word, like spinster. He was like, oh, I thought it was fine.
This is like the equivalent in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the entry next to Earth reading harmless.
Right, exactly. So he didn't know. A lot of guys create this list. It's so funny because I've really found from that story being around that a lot of people have lists. I just never had them because I was either my brain doesn't work like that. I didn't remember a lot of the people, so there'd be blank spaces on the list, which feels like an incomplete. But a lot of people have these lists. They love chronicling their lives in that little point form spreadsheet.
So then the obvious question, this book, to some degree, is that list for you.
I know. It's true. But some people didn't make it in. And I have actually heard from some people, and thanks, Facebook, once again, for existing. Remember when we could lose track of people, Mitch? Oh, those were the days. But I thought it was very funny that one ex-boyfriend wrote me, and I always like, oh, God, here we go. Are they going to be freaking out? And he just wrote, really, 2 years, and all I get is two paragraphs?
Sorry, you are the relationship on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, I was like, hey, it was a good relationship. What do you want from me?
Right. There's that thing. The only thing worse than to be in it is to not be in the book, right?
Right. It's so funny that way. I'm like, you really, you've read these things. You know, I'm sorry you didn't have 300 Garfields in your room. There's nothing I can do about it, okay? I can't go back and rewrite history.
Next time, be weirder.
Yeah, exactly. More tragedy, and you'd make it in, okay?
Well, so then let me ask you this. I mean, this is, I think there is, even if you don't necessarily wish you had lived that life as you read this book, it certainly is vicariously exciting or interesting or compelling. How do you fit that life that you have led into the public radio box?
Right. Well, that's a great question, Mitch. I think, you know, someone asked me something very similar, and I think I'm going to use the same response, which they basically said, how does public radio / NPR feel about the fact that one of their employees wrote a book about sleeping around? And I thought about that very long and hard, and I did a little canvassing for popular opinion here at the Bureau, and it turns out a lot of people in public radio have had sex. I know that's not a very common it's a bit of a misconception. I think foreplay is a lot like a membership drive. I'm not really sure.
Misconception is a good word then.
But it turns out that they are fine with it. But yes, it does make me perhaps one of the racier people at NPR only because I have a book. I'm sure if you really started throwing around some bullet bourbon or whatever these fine people drink around here, you would get some extraordinary stories.
Though in some ways, at least as the host of a comedy show on NPR, it's not as much of a stretch to imagine you writing this as, say, having Carl Castle write it.
Although, you know what? We should sit down with Carl Castle and talk about the early days and see what comes out of him, because I bet he's got some, you know, got some good stories about the panels, people wanting to be on the panel, how they got there. But you're right. I am the jester, more or less, in the public radio world. So they think they give me a little bit of leeway.
It would be interesting to look under the cushions of the NPR casting couch, though.
Yeah, exactly. See what you find. An antenna. Strange.
Well, Ophira Eisenberg, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mitch.
Ophira Eisenberg is host of NPR's Ask Me Another, which airs Saturdays at noon on this very station. Her memoir is called Screw Everyone, Sleeping My Way to Monogamy, published by Seal Press. It is also worth pointing out that we air Saturdays and Sundays as well, 3 p.m. here on 89.7 FM. We are produced by Dan Harmon, Bonnie North, and Stephanie Lecce, with support from producer Amy Kiley, engineer John Strelecki, and our team of interns, Eleanor Peterson, Rachel Bloom, Gabby Magallanes, and Nathan Royster. I'm Mitch Teich. Have a great and hopefully warmer weekend, and I do hope you can be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.